I'm going to pray and then we'll dive in. Father, thank you for this morning. Thank you for sending Jesus. Thank you that Jesus pursues us, that he comes out after us. Thank you that nothing can separate us from your love. And I just, yeah, I love you for you, Jesus. So let me pray. Amen. All right, guys, if you knew, we're in a series. By the way, if you're here, you're the Navy SEALs of church people because a lot of people are not here. Thanksgiving. We're a church full of a lot of young people, and typically people go, man, does your church blow up during the holidays? It's like, no, they all leave to go to their parents' house in the suburbs. We're a young church in the city. But if you're here today, we really appreciate all those. Some of you guys, then we got some parents in the house that you guys came down here, which I appreciate. Do that. Come on. All right, do that, parents. All right, here we go. So we're in a series called Revealed. We're going through the Gospel of John, the Book of John, a account of the life, teachings, death, resurrection of Jesus, written by one of his closest friends, a guy that became the Apostle John, a man who would end up being exiled for his faith, a guy who suffered much for Jesus. He really believed this stuff. And the goal of this book, he says at the very end, is that you would believe in Jesus. The whole point of the book's laid out. There are a lot of books that at the end of them, you're like, man, what was the author thinking? I remember I used to love literature classes when you'd like work through, okay, what's this author getting on about? What's really going on here? Kind of reading between the lines. And with John, you don't have to do that a ton because he just tells you. My hope is that you would believe in Jesus, that he is the Son of God, that you put your faith in him, come to know and be saved out of your sins. And so we've gone through that book for a while. And Jesus, so far, has come on the scene. He was born. God became flesh, became a man. He started doing a bunch of miracles. His fame is spreading. Recently, he has started to really get controversial. He is a dude with controversy surrounds him everywhere he goes. He is famous or infamous, depending on how you view him. And the religious elite in Israel do not like him. Matter of fact, they hate him. Hate him so bad, they want to kill him. They're actively plotting and seeking out ways to kill him. And in the middle of that, we're going to see Jesus interact with one person today, and it's going to kind of really set the stage for this thing to really blow up. This controversy is going to get even more controversial, and it's going to lead to the second half of the book of John. So we'll be in verse 1 today, and it's Jesus healing a man. I'm going to read the entire chapter. I'll comment a little bit, and then I have just 3 points that we'll take from these. All right, so I'm going to read John chapter 9, starting in verse 1. It says, as he passed by Jesus, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Side note, crazy, insensitive, emotionally unintelligent dudes right here. How immature are you? In front of a blind guy. Why is this guy blind? His sin or his mom's? Dude, jeez Louise. Jesus answered, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Having said these things, we'll get into this in a second. Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud, right? Kind of an awkward moment if you're the disciples. Jesus spits, puts it on the guy's eyes. And then verse 7 says, and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. The neighbors, again, this guy blind from birth. So I want you to think about this for a second. Just close your eyes for a second. I'm not going to steal your part. You can trust us. Close your eyes for a second. Legit close them. Just take a second. And imagine you've been like this your entire life. What you see right now is what you have seen your entire life. And then imagine this man, he puts something in your eyes, you're not sure what it is, you're not too stoked about it, but then you go and you rinse it out with water, and then you open your eyes. You see. Everything is new. Every person. You've never seen your parents before. Never mind the guy who just healed you. It's just, you've never seen your own hands. Like, man, I know that, like the back of my hand. You don't know the back of your hand. You don't know anything. And all of a sudden you can see everything. They've done studies on people who had cataracts in their eyes, and they had them removed, and they could see again. They went from blind to being able to see. And they said that actually for a lot of the people who can see again, it's traumatic. That they go from their world being very small to being very big, very manageable, to very scary and out of control. You would think not seeing would make you more anxious, but actually if you've never seen, seeing is crazy. There's an account of one guy saying, make it stop or I'm going to gouge out my eyes. That's how insane it was to see for the first time. So this would be so overwhelming, so wild. And in this context in Israel, to be disabled, a common view was that you're being punished by God. That the reason for that was God was punishing you for your sin or your parents' sin, kind of generational sin thing. We'll get into that in a second. But you're desperate. And you spent your whole life here. And you can't get a job. People think you're cursed. You can't get a job. People know you're blind. You're not let into the temple. You can go on and on and on. The ways that your life's prohibited. You can't have a family. You can't work a job. And so this guy can't see at all. But the irony of this story is the guy who was blind who can see sees Jesus clearer than anyone else in the story. And the other thing you're going to see is... with Jesus being born blind, is the massive transformation in this guy's life. Again, you've never seen your entire life. Now you can see he is so different that they literally don't think he's him. Like, this is someone else. This couldn't be. Blind people don't see again. But again, he would have looked the same. Maybe even his countenance changes. And again, we see that Jesus transforms. Verse 8, the neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? Some said, it is he. Others said, no, but he is like him. He kept saying, I am the man. So they said to him, then how are your eyes opened? He answered, the man called Jesus, made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received my sight. They said to him, where is he? He said, I do not know. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. So now they're taking him to kind of the religious establishment, the guys who hate Jesus again. That are kind of a murderous plot going, kind of a side story. And they bring this guy to Jesus. They bring this guy to the religious leaders. And they go, hey, this guy was blind. Now he can see. He has some stuff to share. And again, in this culture, they would have had a lot of authority. It's not just like me as a pastor. I might have authority in a church. They would have had a lot of authority in the Roman Empire at this time in Israel. They would have had a lot of authority to enforce their own laws. They had their own police. They had their own guards. They had their own court system. There were certain things that Rome had to be involved in, things like taxes and executions. But other than that, man, they could do a lot. So they had a lot of power. So to bring him in, it's like he's being brought into an elders meeting mixed with the Supreme Court is probably the best way to describe it. And he's got to testify. Verse 14, now it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened the eyes. So the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, he put mud on my eyes and washed and I see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God. He does not keep the Sabbath. But others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. So, again, they're trying the people are trying to fall in love with Jesus. People are starting to follow Jesus. He's come on the scene preaching this scandalous message that the prostitutes and the tax collectors are entering the kingdom of God ahead of the religious leaders, which, again, they hate. So the religious leaders want to discredit him with everything they have. So they're always looking. And so they're like, hey, you said you were healed on the Sabbath, right? And they go, okay, here's the thing with the Sabbath. You've got it. You're supposed to rest on the Sabbath. You can't be working. So that he healed you proves that he's a sin, like he was in sin. So if he sinned while he did this miracle, clearly it's not from God. So that's one side of it. And they would have said he was working. Some scholars say that when he spit into the mud and like did this with his hands, it was like he was kneading bread. So it would have been like working. So it's a real religious loophole here. So basically he was working. So basically we should discredit him and reject what he had done. And then the other guy's like, well, listen, dude, I don't know if he, you know, the other side of the Pharisees is division amongst them. So side A is like, he sinned, he disobeyed the Sabbath, he broke the Sabbath, his miracle is therefore invalid. The other guy's like, well, the miracle's valid. The guy can see, and God's not going to do his miracles through sinners. So maybe he's more than that. I don't know. They're a little more open. So then they say, so verse 17, then they keep going. So they said again to the blind man, what do you say about him since he has opened your eyes? The blind man said, he is a prophet. The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, is this your son you say was born blind? How then does he now see? His parents answered, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But how he now sees, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age, he will speak for himself. Verse 22, his parents said these things because they feared the Jews. Again, the Jews, in the context of John, John was a Jew, Jesus was a Jew. It's not anti-Semitic. It means the Jewish leaders. It says, his parents were also Jews. His parents said these things because they feared the Jewish leaders, for the Jewish leaders had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, he is of age, ask him. Okay, so they're like, okay, again, we got this division. If he broke the Sabbath, and his miracles are negated. Well, no, his miracle's real, so maybe he didn't break the Sabbath. And then they go, well, maybe he didn't actually do the miracle. Maybe, yeah, there's a guy who can see now, but maybe he's a stand-in. This is a body double situation. They brought in a guy that looks like the blind guy who's always been able to see. So let's get his parents in here, right? They can ID the man, can ID the body. Is this your son? And see what he says. And they're like, yeah, he is our son, but man, we do not want to be involved. We don't want you guys mad at us. We don't want to get kicked out of the temple. We don't want the social stigma of being ostracized. We don't want to lose work. We don't want to lose status. We don't want to get in trouble. We don't want to associate with Jesus. He's our son, but talk to him. He's of age. He's like, kind of like he's making, like if you, I can imagine, I don't have kids that are older, but I can imagine when your kids are past the age of 18, when they make bad choices, you go, they're adults now. It's not me. That's kind of what they do here. They don't want to be tied to Jesus. If he's tied to Jesus, that's on him. We've got a flimsy string to our son. Son might have a rope to Jesus, but we don't have a rope to Jesus. Like, that's his own thing. So talk to him. So their plan to discredit the miracle doesn't work. So then they bring him in again. They go, so for the second time, they called. And by the way, when religious people just get angry, this is where it goes. So they logically, they tried to, work it out, with the law. Then they try to work it out. Just say, hey, is this even a miracle? Is this actually real? And then they just get mean. Verse 24. So for the second time, they called the man who had been blind. The religious leaders called him and said to him, give glory to God. We know this man is a sinner. Like, hey, give glory to God by discrediting Jesus. It's kind of a false dichotomy, just so you know. Give glory to God. We know this guy's a sinner. And by the way, I love this because he is a blind guy who would have been illiterate, who would not have been well studied. He's talking to the religious power elite who would have studied for years and years and years, studied the law, studied history, and these intellectual cats. He says, he answered, whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. They said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered them, I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? This is amazing. Do you also want to become his disciples? Which they would not have been pumped about. And they reviled him. They hated him. The bitterness and anger and self-righteousness in their hearts just seething. You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from. Again, we're about the Old Testament. We don't know about this guy, even though Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. Verse 30, the man answered, why this is an amazing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. He's like, dude, no one has ever healed a guy who was born blind. This is a miracle. This is something that only God can do. If this, verse 33, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered him, you were born into utter sin and you would teach us. And they cast him out. Jesus heard that they had cast him out. So he goes looking for him. And having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? And I love this because he's actually never seen Jesus to this point, even though he was healed by Jesus. Just like, hey, do you believe in the Son of Man? The Son of Man is a messianic title from the Old Testament, from the book of Daniel. It's referring to Jesus. So he's asking him, hey, do you think I'm the Messiah, essentially? And he says, verse 36, he answered, and who is he that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, you have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. He said, Lord, I believe, and he worshiped him. Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees, these religious leaders, near him heard these things and said to him, Are we also blind? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. So a big idea with this passage is, can you see Jesus? There's a lot of irony in it. There's a lot of, again, there's a physical picture that paints a spiritual picture. A physical picture that points us to a spiritual reality. And so you can see Jesus physically, but can you see him with your heart? Can you see him spiritually? Do you know his identity? Do you know who he is, why he came, what he's here to do? Because here's the thing in life is assuming you can see can lead to some rough consequences. Because in our pride, as humanity, we like to think we can see. We're more like the Pharisees than we are like this blind man, naturally. All of us. Self-righteousness runs, it's not just religious people. It's the anti-religious people. It's everyone in between. That's humanity. We all like to think we're the standard of good. We're the standard, right? Everyone who's more conservative than us is a repressive psycho, and everyone who's more liberal than us is a hippie or whatever it is. Like we have this view, you know, like I have the perfect standard, you know, politically or the way we drive, right? People drive, I heard it was said one time, people drive faster than you are maniacs. People that drive slower than you are grandmas. Sorry to all the grandmas out there. People who don't dress as nice as you, they're slobs. People that dress up a little bit more than you are trying way too hard. Like, you're that standard, right? Worship. People who are less engaged than you, man, they don't even love God. People with their hands up. Oh, look at that guy. He's really going for it. He's really trying. Really trying to impress everyone here. I do that at my house. I don't do it in front of these people. I'm not trying to get everyone's approval. Whatever. Again, we think we're the standard. We think we can see clearly. Oh, I know who Jesus is, right? And it turns to people, how many times I've talked to people and they've said to me, oh, I think Jesus is like this. Cool, you think that. Where'd you get that from? Cool. And again, oftentimes we're viewed as being self-righteous, you know, as Christians, because we've believed in Jesus concretely. Like, you think you know the way? It's like, I'm standing on thousands of years of history and tradition and texts to the test of time. They could be wrong, but it's better than I just think this. What's a more arrogant approach? You by yourself? Listen to two podcasts and watch one YouTube video, or walking in the humility of something that's been around for a very long time. But again, assuming we see can lead to rough consequences. Me and my wife Jackie, we decided to plant the church. We walked away from a very secure job at a mega church in the Bay Area that was going to pay us a lot more money than we ever thought we could make in ministry. And we walked away from it before we stepped into that to plant a church. And part of planting a church was raising about a third of what that church would have paid us, raising it. So raising support, which is terrifying. And we were living on our friend's air mattress in their living room because at the last minute we decided not to move and come plant. I'm so glad we planted. Seeing all of you guys now made it worth it. But we had really cramped quarters. It was really dark in this house. This part of the house we're staying in. And so one day we're getting ready for a wedding, and I was in a rush, and I went to go brush my teeth. I started brushing my teeth, and instantly I realized I was brushing my teeth, but it was not toothpaste. And I turned the light on, and it was butt paste, which is a baby diaper rash cream all up in my mouth. Amazing. I'm a germaphobe also, just so you guys know. Another time, a good friend of mine, he worked as a EMT, and a big part of being an EMT, he found out as an entry-level EMT guy, is you actually move a lot of people around from like assisted living, kind of old folks' homes to the hospital, to doctor's appointments. Some of them that are just literally so old and they're in such bad shape that they physically need support just to get there, you know, with their breathing or whatever it is. And he got to this one home, and he was going to take a gal to the doctor, but she was really old, so they want to make sure that they're in the right mind and they're not being forced and like being forced to be taken somewhere and stuff. So they do these checks, like, hey, do you know who you are? Do you know what day? You know what day it is? Do you know where you are? And so my friend, you know, he sat down and he said, hey, do you know where you are? And she's like, I don't know where I am. And she was really upset, kind of crabby. He said, what's your name? She's like, why do you need to know my name? He's like, cuz I'm trying to take you to this place. She's like, fine, my name's Susan Wills or whatever. And then he says, hey, what color like shirt am I wearing right now, or something like that? She's like, I don't know, you know. And he's like, hey, what's your birthday? And she's like, why do you know my birthday? He's like, again, to verify your identity, to make sure you're of sound mind, you want to go to this place, want to take care of you. And then he said, okay, where are we right now? And she just said, I don't know. And then finally he said, can you just open your eyes and look around and tell me where we are? And she said, I can't. And he said, why can't you? And she said, because I'm blind. To which he said, my partner is going to take you out to the ambulance. I'm so sorry. And again, we have these moments in our lives where we can assume something, we could be so wrong, and we can whiff so hard, and we can hurt ourselves, we can hurt others, we can have funny, awkward moments, we can also have really brutal moments. And that's the reality spiritually, is can we see clearly? Even just now, I saw this mic stand, and I saw this part of the stand, I thought it was the top part where the mic is, and instantly I was like, oh my gosh, there's no mic, and I went back to Curtis. I was like, hey dude, is there a mic? Sarah's about to do offering. He's like, yeah, it's behind there. I was like, yeah, but I don't know if it's there. And then it was. It was fine. Yeah, in our arrogance, though, we go, no, I don't know. I think I see something I don't see. And so with this story, we see that Jesus is seen clearly by one guy, a guy who cannot see. And then we see that the guys who claim to see, they came to be teachers. They claim to be these important people who just know everything. These arbiters of truth don't seem to know anything. I believe in this story with Jesus, this man demonstrates the humility and open-heartedness necessary to believe in Jesus. He demonstrates how Jesus transforms people, and he demonstrates how that process happens. So I want to move through these quick. I've got 3 points. One is the cure of Jesus. 2 is the controversy of transformation. And 3 is the progression of confession. That rhymes. I know. It's amazing. It's all me. First thing I want to look at is the cure. Okay, number one, the cure of Jesus. I'm just kidding, guys, but you know, the cure of Jesus. And it's this idea that we have to admit that we're blind to receive our cure. This guy, again, he is blind in a culture where it's very tough to be blind. He would have just begged and asked for money. People are most charitable when they're going to church. They're going to the synagogue. He's begging by the synagogue. And his disciples just ask this ridiculous Michael Scott level awkward question. Is this guy blind, or is this guy blind from birth because his parents were in sin, or he was in sin? Right? It's a weird implication because he had sinned in the womb. It's kind of weird. Who sinned that he was born blind? And again, it's a false dichotomy, but it's rooted in their worldview. Again, many Jews at this time believe that suffering was often a result, was a consequence of sin. That, I believe, is still alive today. It's alive and well around North Park. It's the belief. It's called karma. It's the idea that you doing right or wrong in this life, or you doing right or wrong in a past life, is why you are suffering today. And the only way to make it right is to do good, to balance the scales. Now, again, that might be an okay belief if your life's going pretty good. I'm rich. I'm not sick. People like me. And you know why? Because I was so dope in my last life. Or the way I treated people in college is how I got to where I am today. But this kind of answer is no answer to people who are in the face of real suffering. Like, how does helping the less fortunate change the karma of those who are less fortunate? Like, you're really helping people for yourself, to benefit yourself. It changes your karma, not theirs. This also has kind of a Christian-y version of this, which is just legalism, which is this, I do stuff to get God to bless me. And if he's not blessing me, it must be because I'm not doing the stuff. But a general answer is that sin is the explanation of the brokenness of our world. I think we all want to know, man, why is there suffering in the world? And again, kind of general answer of the scriptures is that sin is the explanation of the brokenness of our world. This idea that humanity rejected God as our king, that we said we want to be our own kings, and in our foolish rejection of him, we've gotten ourselves into a lot of trouble. We're like the foolish kid who pushes his parents away to get to the freedom of the mall, only to realize that he's 8 years old, he's lost, and he's surrounded by creepy people. Just want to do your own thing, and doing your own thing leads to some tough spaces. And what looks like freedom can lead to so much fear and pain, where we hurt ourselves and hurt others, which is not how we were designed. And sin creates a whole world that's marred by it. The fabric of creation was broken when we committed treason against God, who is king. That's what the scriptures teach. And the effects of that sin are everywhere. And you don't have to believe in God to see that. Like, something's broken. It doesn't seem like this is the way it's supposed to be. Everywhere we look, there's a sense, again, that this isn't the way it's supposed to be. The church that sent us out to start this church is located in Thousand Oaks, California. And 2 weeks ago, they experienced both a mass shooting and a fire that burned down countless houses. And as I've talked to multiple people from that community, I spoke at an event they had about 8 days ago. As I talked to them and talked to the leaders there, there's a sense in everyone I talked to saying, man, it's not supposed to be this way. Like, we're not supposed to bury people in their 20s. People aren't supposed to lose their homes in an instant. But again, because of sin, we see war, we see genocide, we see the effects of it, and cancer and broken families and adultery, and go on and on and on. But Jesus came into the world because of sin. He's here to eradicate the world of sin and its effects. There will be a day, according to the book of Revelation, where there will be no more death or sin or mourning or crying or pain. In the Old Testament, there was prophecies that the Messiah would cause the blind to see, which is exactly what Jesus is doing in this passage. Thousands of years before Jesus, there were these prophecies. In the Old Testament, there's also the book of Job, which kind of wrestled with the same question. Job was a righteous man. He loses his family. His body's destroyed. And then he has miserable friends who show up. And they're like, you're in sin. God's punishing you. And at the end of the book, God goes, it's not Job's fault. Job's innocent. Also, your friends are the worst. and he restores everything he has. So here's the big idea with suffering. And we've taught on this before, and we'll teach on it again. That's not the main point of today. But I just want you to see this, is that sometimes there are consequences for our sin. We see this in the book of Proverbs a lot, just the idea of cause and effect, right? If I abuse my body, I will get in trouble, right? If I spend my money frivolously, often a cause will be you end up broke. Some people get lucky, the job they have, whatever it is, but often that's the case. If I value my position at work over my family, I'll overwork and over time. If I'm working 70 hours a week, I don't spend much time with them. Though my kids might go to good schools, they might not actually have a relationship with me. If I cheat on my wife, we will lose intimacy. We can go on and on and on. There's a cause and effect aspect. But there are also consequences for our sin, where God's responding to our sin with consequences, where God may take something away for our good. But a key idea in the New Testament is that this is discipline, not punishment. There's times in love, he takes something away from us. Think of the way a surgeon cuts us open to bring about healing. The goal isn't the cutting open. If it's just cutting open to cut open, you're a maniac. But if it's to bring about healing, right, you're a surgeon. That God, at times in our life, takes away the thing we thought we need to realize we have more than we could ever ask or imagine already. But we can't point to personal sin as the cause of all suffering. Again, the Bible teaches that there are those in this life who get away with awful sin. I was watching listening to a podcast about like how many Nazis fled to South America. And that one of the guys who did some of the I can't even think of a word bad enough, but the most terrible experiments, died of old age on a beach in Brazil. There are people in this world who get away with sin, awful sin, in this life. The Bible also teaches that there are awesome people who will suffer deeply for a season while we're in this life, but they can end up in a space where they realize that Jesus is all they need. And so sometimes God is up to something mysterious. This is probably another option would be sometimes God is up to something mysterious in the midst of our suffering that leads us to a deeper satisfaction in worship, which is what we see here. So as Jesus' disciples kind of riffing about why this guy is blind in front of him, again, so immature, gives me hope for me. Jesus rather than waxing philosophically about why he's blind, like, how about I just heal him? And then this healing, we see the pattern of the salvation, the spiritual healing that Jesus still offers us. That's what I meant. There's the cure of Jesus. We see the dynamics in this story of grace and need that lead to the cure of Jesus. This man has the characteristics of someone in need of saving. Again, he was blind. Those who have not believed in Jesus and have rejected his light, no matter how intellectual they are, can never understand ultimate reality. They can't make sense of spiritual things. C.S. Lewis said this. He said, I believe in Jesus as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. It's not that I personally have seen Jesus, just Jesus makes sense of everything around me, like nothing else does. But he was blind. Again, we're blind naturally without Jesus. He was begging. Those who have rejected Jesus are poor in God's sight, even if they are popular and wealthy in the eyes of the world. They are begging for someone to satisfy their deepest needs. You can watch documentary after documentary, watch interview after interview of wealthy, famous people at the top of their fields who are miserable, who struggle with addiction and depression, who are constantly trying to prove themselves. They're begging for something to satisfy their deepest needs. And he was begging. He saw that clearly. He was helpless. He could not cure himself, and others could not cure him. Jesus' healing, his salvation, is a gift we receive. We cannot work to attain it. Christianity is not for good people who have their act together. It's for bad people who can't get their act together and they ask for help. I grew up in South San Diego. So we guys heard the story before, but every summer we kind of sandlot style, we'd go to the community pool. None of us had pools at our house, but there was a community pool. And I was a chubby kid who could not swim, and I had asthma. So the deep pool wasn't really my vibe. It shouldn't have been, the 12 foot, but that's where the diving pool was. That's where all the cool guys were hanging out, all my friends. And so I'd get to the swim test in the kiddie pool, and I wouldn't pass. My friends would go around. So this one day, I just decided, you know what, I'm just gonna go around the lifeguard and see if they notice me. So I just go around, like, they can't see me. Again, I'm the palest person you've ever seen in your life. Concrete white around the pools. Killing it. It's camouflage. I walk around. I get to the diving board, and I'm like, they don't see me. It's like I'm literally just walking out of jail. They're like, they don't see me? All right, they don't see me. I'm going to keep going. Getting away with this. And I was getting away with it until I jumped off the diving board into a 12-foot pool. Again, as a out-of-shape kid who could not swim and had asthma. And then they saw a white buoy that was turning pink. It's kind of hovering up and down. Guy jumps in, pulls me out, rescues me. Kind of classic lifeguard rescue story, I'm sure. At a pool, very easy. This wasn't a tough Baywatch situation. No jet ski was necessary. It was just, are you strong enough to pull this kid out? And here's what's funny about that story is I've never told that story in a prideful way. I've never been like, yo, there was this time I almost drowned because I couldn't swim and I was out of shape. And I got rescued. I'm so much better than you guys. Look, you guys are so, like, I don't walk around swimming pools doing that. God, I'm so much better than everyone here because I got rescued by a lifeguard once. That'd be foolish. Why? Because the glory's in the lifeguard, not in me. Only thing I contributed to that story is that I made a dumb decision. I lied and I couldn't swim. Jesus rescues. That's why the idea of self-righteous Christian should be an oxymoron. This is a faith rooted in the fact that you're so bad, Jesus had to die for you. This isn't like, I'm better than you. I don't do bad stuff. That's garbage. A lot of people think that's what Christianity is. It's not. All I do is bad stuff. The cure shows his need. The cure also shows how Jesus graciously saves sinners in need. Jesus came to the man in grace. Jesus could have passed by. He could have said, sorry, bro, it's the Sabbath. I need to rest. He could have kept walking. Jesus' cure also, I love this, one commentator said, his cure irritated the man. It says, a speck of dust irritates the eye. Imagine mud in your eyes. But the mud causes him to go wash and pursue cleansing. The gospel does this in that it stings and shows us our sin before it cleanses us of our sin. So I get up here, I have to tell you you're a sinner, like I've been saying for a while. But then I have to go, but by the way, there's someone who covers that sin. Jesus, another thing we see in this is Jesus cured the man by his power. Jesus did it for him, just like he pays our penalty for us on the cross. Again, salvation's a plea deal. It's not innocence. It's Jesus was innocent. He paid the penalty for me so that I might walk free. Jesus cured the man with his power. It wasn't like his power. They worked together for him to not be blind. It was Jesus. It was all Jesus. And Jesus' cure glorified God like it always does. And Jesus' cure transforms his life so much so that they aren't sure it's him. And not just the Pharisees who were trying to trick people. Like earlier on, they were like, is that him? Or is that you? And he's like, I'm me. But I don't know. How do I know you guys are you guys? Because I've been blind the whole time. His transformation actually, and at least my second point, the controversy of transformation. So we see the cure of Jesus, and then we see the controversy of transformation. Here's the idea. Being connected to Jesus and his transformation is noticeable. Being connected to Jesus has consequences. When you walk away from sin to Jesus, people will judge you. It's the irony of Christians being the judgmental ones, and there are a lot of Christians who are judgmental who bum me out a lot. They're on TV way too often. I would CNN, I'm down to do an interview, and I'll be way better. But you probably don't want that, which is kind of the vibe. The idea Christians are so judgmental. Watch, follow Jesus faithfully and see how everyone treats you. They'll mock you. Make fun of you, egg you on. Being connected to Jesus leads to his people. Being connected to Jesus leads to this guy's parents walking away from him in a time of need, his neighbors rejecting him, and the Pharisees kicking him out of the temple. There is a cost for him. There is a cost for us. There always has been. We felt it less in American history. Now we're feeling it more. But in the history of the world, following Jesus has always had consequences. Actually following Jesus, not ticking the box Christian when you take the census. Like, actually, I'm devoted to Jesus Christ more than I am my own life. That kind of following which Jesus calls us to. There's a cost. I was at an event recently, and this guy spoke, and I spoke on evangelism. He talked about he planted a church in Santa Monica. He's from London originally. He was a lawyer in London, planted a church in Santa Monica as a pastor. And he said, man, literally no one wants anything to do with it. I'm like a pariah. He said, Christians used to be the goody two-shoes of society. You would mock. He said, now what's wrong with society? If you guys just stopped believing what you believe, the world would move forward. He said, my first 2 days in LA, I got invited to an event at a bar. I went to the bar. He said, the guy flaked on me because that's Southern California, I guess. But I showed up and I was having a beer. And he said, I was talking to these people. And instantly, they said, hey, what do you do? And instantly, I didn't want to tell them. I said, guys, the conversation's going so great. We're 30 minutes in. And he said, I'm actually here to start a church. I'm a pastor. And he said, one guy just took his beer, turned around, walked away. Said the second guy said, but you're so nice. He said, and there's a third one. This gal was just there. She said she started kind of crying. It was kind of awkward. He's like, I think she felt conviction, but she didn't want to talk about it. So I just excused myself, walked away. All right, that's all he said. He said his wife was fired from her job as a hairstylist about 2 years later. He said she had been crushing it. They found out she was a pastor very quickly. They assumed a lot of the people that worked there were in the LGBT community. They assumed because he was a pastor, he hated LGBT people. This is a lie, again, that gets propagated all the time. And so you can just see, man, like being connected to Jesus, man, there is cost. I met another guy one time who, he's a Christian from Iran, and he told me his dad became a believer, whole family became believers, in a very intense, very kind of extreme brand of Islam in their neighborhood. Became a follower of Jesus in Iran, and he said they had a gathering where a guy walked in with a gun, literally, and shot up the church while he was there. Killed their pastor. And he said, my dad sat us down about a week later, said, we have to decide, do we really believe this or not? Because if we don't, it's not worth it. If it's true, it's worth everything. But if it's not true, it's not worth an ounce of our time to make our life complicated like this. There is a cost to following Jesus. It could be extreme like Iran. It could look your friends mocking you, but man, it's there. But here's the thing, if there's no cost to your faith, is your faith discernibly, is it real? Does it change to where people notice, for good or for bad? It might, again, if it's not real, if there's no transformation, man, have you actually put your faith in Jesus? A good way to test that is, are you becoming like Jesus over 10, 20, 30 years? Are you actually becoming like Jesus? I don't hate on people that tell me they were 5 and they got saved. I think my son got saved at 7. He was breaking down, confessing sin to me on Thanksgiving, totally on his own. I was like, man, you got stuff. Spirit's new stuff in you. He doesn't do it. A lot of people I know who claim to follow Jesus for a long time. I don't care how old you were, but do you keep following, like Royce talked about? Are you committed to becoming just like this amazing man? 2 Corinthians 5:17 says this. It says, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old is passed away. Behold, the new has come. Is there a newness to you? I think the theological term is that new, right? Are you progressively becoming like Jesus? Can you actually go, I used to be this way and I'm becoming someone new? I'm not perfect. I fall, but do you get up? Do you keep going? Are you becoming like him? And that transformation can be beautiful, but it can also be controversial. It's like an addict who's been freed from substance abuse that doesn't use anymore, and his friends think he's lame. They try to draw him back in. A group of guys used to go out and just talk trash about their wives. They just gossip about the old ball and chain, just kind of riff. And you meet Jesus. You go, I'm supposed to love my wife like Jesus loves the church. That's what this teaches, and I'm following this now. And then it's awkward because I don't really jump in. I even encourage them, like, hey, let's talk about something else. Oh, you got a perfect marriage? Oh, he's a Christian now. Great marriage. It's like, no, it's not, but I'm working on it, right? The guy you used to sleep with, who not only is sexually frustrated that you now want to follow Jesus, but he feels judged by you. Right? Oh, you think you're better than me? Right? And again, when we walk in the light, sometimes this offends those who still pursue the darkness. And by the way, our job is not to... By the way, people... Persecutions, when it's because you're tied to following Jesus and becoming like him. It's not you being a jerk, okay? I'm not talking Angela at the office. If you're a jerk, right, and people are jerks, that's different. I'm talking... Your life's being transformed, and they're like insecure about that because they see the light in you, and they're like, wait, I'm in darkness. Not because you don't need to tell people you're in darkness, but as they see you, you're walking an abundant life. Like, man, that's not mine. I got to tear that down, right? Or I have to convince you. I tell family that doesn't know Jesus, and all the time I tell them, man, what I told you guys earlier, man, Christianity is not for good people. It's for really bad. They're like, you're good. No, you're good. you're good. I'm like, no, dude. I'll say, I'm wicked in my heart. They go, no, you're not. You know why? It's not about me. It's if you're bad. Frick. I know you're a better husband than me. And I'm not a perfect husband at all. I've got a lot of sin and jacked upness, but I'm making an effort they're not making. So like, if you're bad, if you're wicked, what the hell am I? Is what that means. See what I'm saying? And so that happens. So again, I'm not talking about you being judgy and being a jerk. I'm saying your life's actually being transformed to where as you walk in the light, the darkness feels darker in the light. Does that make sense? And so we see that in his life. Again, we never need to condemn people or tell people they're in darkness. That's not our core message. Again, we can talk more about that. So we see him paying for the price for being associated with Jesus. But I just want you to see this real quick. I think this is amazing. So I'm going a little bit longer than normal. You guys got five? Good? Last thing? Okay. Before we get to the last point, in verse 34, the religious leaders kick him out. They say, you were born in utter sin. You think you can teach us? And they cast him out of the synagogue. This is so confusing for him, probably. I thought I was cursed by God my whole life because I was blind. I've been healed. I'm assuming God had something to do with that. And then I'm told, you can't come in. So I couldn't come in because I was blind. Now I've been healed and I can't come in. Where is God? Like, I'm confused, man. Like, who is God? What's he about? I don't get it. And there are so many people, there's so many people who have felt this way. And I just want to point out that maybe you feel like you've been pushed aside by Jesus or even Jesus' church. People who claim to be Jesus, claim to be followers of Jesus. Maybe you've experienced a rejection or a wound or pain or you confess sin and then, yeah, you were rejected. But I love what happens in verse 35. It says, Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? And by the way, to hear he was cast out and then to find him means he went looking for him. Like, I love that the minute this guy thinks, I can't be in the presence of God, God goes and finds him. Oh, he's been kicked out. I gotta go find him and reconcile with him. And that leads to this third point, which is the progression of confession. What I love about this text is it shows a man in process being pursued by Jesus. Some of you guys have amazing camp high moments when you believed in Jesus. The lights came on. It was like, boom, ready to roll, Jesus. Lights, camera, action, Jesus. Literally, it's like a light switch got flicked on and you could just see clearly. Others of you guys have experienced believing Jesus, not like a light switch, but like a dimmer. Bianca described Sarah Ballard, who did the offering talk today. She became a Christian in this church. And she said her conversion wasn't like a light switch. It was like the sun slowly rising. There's a church in Philadelphia called 10th Presbyterian. And the pastors there described a guy that got saved in his church. And he said, the guy said this. He said, when I first came to this church, I didn't agree with anything the pastor said about Jesus. Now I think I agree with everything the pastor says about Jesus. I have no idea when that happened. And so we see this progression, progressively understanding who Jesus is. And so most of us, if you're here today and you aren't sure about what you believe about Jesus, I just want to say that's okay. Spoiler alert, I'm a Christian pastor. I believe he's God. Crazy idea, I know. Man, who is God? But it's okay if you aren't there yet. But he isn't just not sure. He's open to understanding more about Jesus. Like, he's humble enough to say he doesn't know. The amount of times in this text he says, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. His life's changing. He's like, I don't really know why. I'm just... it's Jesus guy, but I don't really know all the details. By the way, just to say this, if you become a follower of Jesus and if you're a new follower of Jesus, your story is already valuable. He literally doesn't know who Jesus is, but he's been impacted by him and he's sharing what he does know. And so much is happening. By the way, I think one thing that's important though is he's not just, again, open to understanding more about Jesus. He's humble enough to admit he doesn't know. And I want to say this, I think in our culture, we can make an idol of being open-minded. And what that can mean is, open-minded can mean I never land anywhere. Open-minded means I'm open to all possibilities. It doesn't mean I can't land somewhere until I've been convinced of something else. You know what I'm talking about? Like, open-mindedness is really just code for cynicism. I was sitting, again, so he's not the cynical guy who says, man, nothing's knowable. Who knows? It's all the same. It's not. If you've done any research, it's not all the same. Can all be wrong. It is not all the same. I was sitting in a conference session recently, and the speaker said this, a gal named Dana. She's going to be here in a few weeks to preach on worship. It's going to be amazing. But she said this. She said, Western culture has cultivated the idea for centuries that the skeptical person is always smarter than the one who believes. Individualism mixed with our insecurities causes us to think this way. She said, this idea starts so young. She said, all you have to do is sit on a playground and watch how kids interact with each other. Whoever wants to be cool reaches for the lowest common denominator, which is this: to be cool or smart, I don't have to believe anything. I just have to belittle what you believe. That's so much of our culture right now, right? This is kind of the heart of hipster culture, which our church is swimming in, right? I can appreciate much about hipster culture, but cynicism's not something I'm trying to take with me. Oh, you like that? Right? You ever told us, oh, you believe that? You eat that? Oh, that music is so commercial, right? What's your favorite? Ask this question. Don't ask them what God you believe. What's your favorite musical artist? Freeze. What if they've heard of this artist first? What if they think the artist is lame, right? And this is in church too. You're gonna put your hands up when you worship? Wow, really going for it. Cynicism isn't inherently intellectually superior to belief. At best, this is so huge. At best, it's fear that doesn't want to get hurt or let down again if what I believe turns out not to be true. At worst, it's caring what people think more than you care about what is actually true. Cynicism is not, you're not just smart because you're cynical. You could be, but not necessarily. But if you're truly open-minded and open-hearted, so true open-mindedness is, maybe I could become a disciple of Jesus. I talked to people before and I said, man, if I could convince you the resurrection of Jesus happened, would you believe he was God? Like, nah, probably not. You're not actually open-minded. But we see this in this guy's life. Watch how the way he describes Jesus keeps changing and climaxes in a confession of faith, that progression of confession. Verse 11, he calls him a man called Jesus. It's like the way Olivia would talk about him. A man called Jesus. It's my daughter, by the way. She's 3. Verse 17, he tells the Pharisees he's a prophet. Verse 33, he says Jesus is a man from God. Which leads us to verse 35, which is really the end of his progression of confession. It's his actual confession. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, and who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, for you have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. He said, Lord, I believe, and he worshiped him. There's a point where it's okay to, if you actually believe he is who he is, you can confess that and just believe in him and follow him. Some of us are like, we're nervous to like, and again, if you end up in a space, you're like you can say, man, as far as I know, Jesus, you are who you are. You did what you did. I'm going to follow you. And he has this moment. You don't have to be afraid of that moment. You don't have to protect yourself with cynicism and fear. Like, you can step into that space. And also, this is, I want to call the worship band up. This also isn't just true of like becoming a follower of Jesus, which, by the way, if you're here, again, whatever journey you're on, we're pumped you're here. This is true for us who are followers of Jesus. That we're all progressively walking out of the darkness into the light to become like Jesus. And it's going to take faith for us to go, am I sure? Like, if I give him my whole life, that man, like, this part of my life, like, I'm cool gambling 9/10 of this, but this 1/10, I don't know. It's okay to go, man, for now, I'm trusting him. And we'll see what happens. We'll see if he falls through and does what he says he does with this. If he really loves me, and if he really is going to take care of me, whatever that looks like. Could be your job, could be your sexuality, could be your finances, could be your romantic relationships, could be a hobby. I don't know what it is for you. Could be your parenting, where you go, Jesus, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to step out in faith and see what you do. So I wanted to move into a space. I really just want us to, for those of us who are here and you've put your faith in Jesus before, man, I would love to just worship Jesus. I would love to just sing together like this moment at the end, this moment of worship. You are the Son of God, and you worshiped him. Nothing you notice about that is there probably wasn't a worship band there when he worshiped him. I think oftentimes, by the way, I think Ruth and Carlo are amazing. I think oftentimes we're like dependent on the music or how we feel. It's like, no, you are who you are. I'm responding to you. And by the way, it's also, you can worship your way out of a space of cynicism. But I want to call us into to singing to him, to worshiping him. We are going a little bit long, so we'll do 2 songs. Then we'll do what we call a soft close. So if you need to, that would be time if you have kids to go pick them up. If you need to leave, we understand. We're not going to judge you. But we'll still do another song after that. There'll still be some time to get prayer. If you're here today and you want prayer for anything, I'm in the front row with my wife, Allison, eldest wife, a couple other people, Hillary over here. We'd love to pray for you. Wherever you're at in the journey, if you're, it's, you're struggling to believe Jesus, believe in Jesus for the first time, or you're struggling to believe in Jesus as you fall into a certain area for the first time, we'd love to pray for you. This would be a time where you meet with him, and like this guy, you can engage with him. So would you guys stand with me to worship?